In today's talk, I'm gonna jump and talk about two very different but very interesting phenomena. But before diving right in, I would like to just step back for a moment and just say a few words about the tool that I use and that will allow me to connect this this phenomena, namely effective theories. So it's a remarkable fact about nature that everywhere we look in nature, there appears to be interesting phenomena to study at all different landscapes. And over the past of 200 years, we've been poking and probing over 40 orders of magnitude in land scales and an equally impressive range of energy scale and time scales. And everywhere we looked, we found interesting phenomena. And just in the last few years, you know, we managed to expand our understanding of this range at both sides. On this side, in 2012 with the discovery of the Higgs, and at completely the opposite side more recently with the recent first detection of gravity waves from binary black holes and binary neutron stars. So when facing such a range, impressive range of a hierarchy of land scales, there are two immediate good news that that leap at us. The first one is that there are lots of interesting problems to work on, so much so that we can afford to fund an institute like PI and have a lot of people that work on these different problems. The second piece of good news is that luckily we don't need to understand all these phenomena at once in order to make progress in physics, and that's because they happen at different landscales that are often separated by very wide hierarchies. And because of that, we are often able to isolate a certain set of phenomena that we are interested in studying from everything else and focus on those. And when we write down a theory in physics that isolates this phenomena, what we're writing down is an effective theory. Namely, we are looking for an appropriate description of the important physics that captures the phenomena that we're interested in. So I really like this quote by Lisa Randall. I think it really captures the pragmatic essence of an effective theory. And the idea is really to start from what are the quantities that you can actually measure, and then write down a theory that allows you to describe those quantities. Now, the theory you write down is not going to be probably the theory of everything or the ultimate truth, but it's going to be, at any moment in time, the closest approximation to nature that you need, and also the limit of what you can test. Now, in the past few years, I really got a lot of mileage out of using effective field theory techniques, and I was able to apply them to a variety of problems ranging from cosmology to astrophysics to applications in condensed matter. And along the way, I was fortunate enough to work with a fair number of outstanding graduate students whose name I've highlighted here in bold. But for the sake of today's talk, I'm just going to focus on two of these lines. And I'm going to tell you a bit about astrophysical spinning objects.
They're not outstanding.
They're equally outstanding, but more senior. So I'm going to focus on astrophysical spinning objects, and in particular describe how we can capture dissipative phenomena that involve them. And then in the second part of the talk, I'm going to discuss about collective excitation in superfluids, and in particular rotons. And one of the goals of this talk will be to show you how, using the same set of ideas and techniques, we can actually describe both spinning black holes and rotons in superfluids. Now, rather than starting with a very broad and very theoretical introduction to effective theories, I'm just going to very briefly remind you about the first effective theory that we have all encountered in the first week of our Physics 101 course, namely the theory of a point particle. Okay? I'm sure all of us at some point we've had to solve a problem like this, where you need to figure out the trajectory of a cannonball. Of course, it was natural for us to just focus on the coordinates that describe the position of the cannonball and how they evolve in time, right? And in fact, because this motion was on a plane, we just could get away with two coordinates. But in general, we would need three. And then when we got a little better and we were assigned slightly more complicated problems, we were asked, for instance, to figure out how the orientation of a rigid body changes over time. And we discovered that to do that, we needed to keep track of three Euler angles. So bottom line, for to keep track of a rigid object, most of the times you can get by with three coordinates and three Euler angles, as we all know. Of course, this, as theoretical physicists, feels second nature to us, but if you step back for a moment, it's actually quite remarkable. So a spinning top or a cannonball are actually quite complicated objects. So why is it that in most of the cases we can get rid of just keeping track of six quantities? And the way I like to think of this is because this follows from a very, is a consequence of a very general phenomenon, such as spontaneous symmetry breaking. Meaning the idea that oftentimes the ground state of a system in nature has fewer symmetries than the equations of motions that describe its behavior. So this happens everywhere on the range of landscapes that I showed earlier. It plays an important role in our understanding of the electroweak force, of course. It happens in ferromagnets, which are described by equations that are isotropic, and yet when you go below the critical temperature, the spins pick a preferred directions that break exotropy. And it happens also for discrete symmetries. For instance, molecules like sugar, they're chiral. They could, in principle, have two orientations, but somehow nature has chosen to use only one, and that's the one we can digest. Now, the concept of spontaneous symmetry breaking, of course, is particularly important when the symmetry that is spontaneously broken is a global continuous symmetry, because in that case, a powerful theorem in quantum field theory, namely Goldstone theorem, tells us that there are going to be a certain number of gapless modes in the system, meaning modes that require, that can be always excited no matter how little energy you put in the system. And the reason why these modes are particularly important is because often these are the modes that dominate the long wavelength, low energy behavior of the system. All right? Wait. Yes?
How spontaneous symmetry breaking appears in the spinning top?
Wonderful. This is exactly my next slide. So let's go back now and consider a generic object, even more irregular than a top. Let me take, for instance, a potato. Okay? When I look at it from very far away, in a limit where I can approximate it as point-like, I realize that this object breaks a bunch of space-time symmetries. It breaks translations because it's here rather than somewhere else. It breaks rotations because it has an irregular shape. And it also breaks boosts because it selects a preferred reference frame in which it is at rest. Okay? And so the Goldstone modes associated with all these broken symmetries are precisely the three coordinates and the three Euler angles. Now, for those of you in the audience who are quite familiar with the standard Goldstone theorem, you know that actually applies to internal symmetries, in which case you have a one-to-one correspondence between the number of broken symmetries and the number of Goldstone modes. Now, this is not true anymore when you break, in general, space-time symmetries. And a simple example of that is, you know, if you consider a brain or a membrane, right? It breaks a lot of space-time symmetries. It breaks, in general, you know, rotations in these directions. It breaks translations. And it breaks all the boosts that mix the coordinates on the brain with the coordinates outside of the brain. But in fact, there is only one light mode that we can excite, the transverse vibrations of the membrane. And so that's the case where you break a lot of space-time symmetries, but you only have one Goldstone mode. Now, the reason why I like to think of a point particle in these terms is because then I can export very powerful techniques from field theory, in particular one known as Cosette construction, that allows you to write down an effective action for Goldstone mode starting solely from the knowledge of the symmetry breaking pattern. So what symmetries do you have and how are they broken? And in the particular case of a point-like particle, for instance, it allows me very easy to write down an effective action that in the case where the object is relativistic and for simplicity is spherical, looks like that. Now, I should say this is not the only way of writing down an effective action for a relativistic spinning object, but I find this approach particularly convenient for a couple of reasons. The first one is that this action depends exclusively on the physical degrees of freedom, the three coordinates and the three Euler angles, okay? And for the experts in the audience, basically this approach corresponds to a particularly clever choice of a spin supplementary condition. Now, the second thing to emphasize is that Lorentz boosts are non-linearly realized here. So as you see, I have contractions between three vectors. So if you just look at this, it doesn't look manifestly Lorentz invariant, but in fact it is. It's just that Lorentz invariant is realized non-linearly. The third thing that I want to mention is that all these terms have a fairly simple physical interpretation. Of course, the first one is just the action for a point-like particle if we forget about the spin. The second one is just a relativistic generalization of what we would write down when we describe a non-relativistic rigid body, right? It's the rotational kinetic energy.
The problem is that the rigid body constraint is not Lorentz invariant, right?
But I think in the point-like limit, I don't care.
But the rigid body is defined by the rigid body constraint. That the distance between two points within the rigid body is constant.
That's right, but that is a problem. That is something that I need to worry about when I'm looking at the rigid body at scales where I actually care about what's going on inside. If I look at it just, if I'm only interested in the low energy limit, in the large scale limit, where I don't care about the internal structure, this problem, which normally you will need to worry about, you can just forget it. Because again, the low energy behavior is just fixed by symmetries, and there is no ambiguity there.
You can forget it to some given order, but eventually it will.
That's right. Yeah. So I should say for now, for what I'm going to say today, that is not going to, is not going to matter. Yeah. But there is a way to encode the fact that the object actually has a finite size. And that brings me to my next point. So normally, we would write down just the first couple of terms. But in fact, in the spirit of effective theories, once we have identified degrees of freedom and symmetries, our action should contain all possible terms that we can write down, so an infinite series of them. And the only reason why usually we can get away with writing down only a finite number of terms is because not all terms are equally important. All right? So in particular, this term that I wrote over here is going to be suppressed compared to this term by this ratio of the angular velocity of the object divided by the typical frequencies of the object, the typical normal frequencies of vibration. And the only reason why usually we don't write this guy down is because we are interested in things that spin relatively slowly compared to these normal frequencies. But this is not always the case. So for instance, if I take a skateboard wheel and I make it spin really, really fast, at some point the object will start deforming. And if I keep going, eventually it's just going to break down. And so what these extra terms capture is the deformation or the change in the moment of inertia of the object that occurs when the objects are spinning at an appreciable rate. All right. So now, this is all very nice. There are interesting processes where keeping track of only coordinates and angles is not enough. And these usually, for instance, are dissipative processes. So processes where you have a particle and, let's say, some wave gets absorbed. Now, the reason why angles and coordinates now are not enough is because dissipation is a process in which momentum and energy is transferred from large-scale degrees of freedom, so Euler angles and coordinates, but also long wavelength modes of fields that might interact with our particle. And so this energy momentum get transferred to smaller scales. And the way in which we encode these degrees of freedom, microscopic degrees of freedom that we usually neglect, is by adding an infinite tower of operators with different number of indices that they're going to mock essentially the effect of these microscopic degrees of freedom. And so what we do is we improve our action by adding a bunch of couplings. So in particular, if we're interested in interactions with some scalar field, we're going to add a coupling like this, O with phi, or couplings that involve derivatives of phi, and so on and so forth, where making sure to include this Lorentz boost here that takes us from the lab frame where these derivatives live to the rest frame of the object where these operators live. All right.
Sorry, I mean, is it always the case you're going to think that this energy will dissipate to smaller scales? Can you capture anything that will dissipate to longer scales?
Well, in a way, yes, I can capture both things. And in fact, yeah, that's a very good point. So now I'm going to show you first how I'm going to first show you how, using this technique, I can describe, say, an absorption process. But then together with that, there is going to be a spontaneous emission process that is associated with it, and it's inevitable. And that you could think of it as a process where you have a transfer of energy momentum that goes in the opposite direction, in a way.
Does that implicitly imply that you have some kind of equilibrium at these small scales?
So at this stage, I haven't made that approximation, but I'm going to do it in a moment.
I mean, you're characterizing these small scales with just very few numbers, so you assume something there.
Exactly, no, but at this stage, you know, I'm just telling you, I'm going to consider an infinite number of operators. I'm going to add an infinite number of couplings to my Lagrangian. And the only constraint is really symmetry. So at this stage, there is nothing wrong that I can do if I just include everything, right? But at some point, to make progress, I'm going to need to make some approximations. And then I'm going to spell them out. So like I said, let me consider the simplest dissipative process, namely an absorption process. And just for simplicity, let me consider a scalar wave that is absorbed by a point particle. And let me consider, I'm going to focus also on a mode with angular momentum L equal 1. Okay? But everything I say here can be easily extended to higher multiples and higher spins. So the interaction that I want to add to my Lagrangian looks like this. Has one derivative acting on phi, because I'm interested in modes with L equal 1. And has this rotation that, again, takes me from the lab frame to the rest frame of the object. And the process I want to look at is an absorption process that I can write like this. So my spinning object is in some state xi. And I have a quantum with frequency omega and angular momentum lnm that gets absorbed. And as a result, my spinning object jumps to a state xf. So by using standard rules to calculate an absorption probability, and working at lowest order in perturbation theory, the kind of result that I get is like this. When I calculate an inclusive absorption probability, where I sum over all possible states of the spinning object. And so there are two things that I want to point out about this result. The first one is that, like I said, is non-zero only for L equal 1. But that's because I calculated it using this interaction. If I had added interactions with more derivatives, then I would have also those would contribute to absorption of higher L modes. And the second one is that this absorption probability is crucially determined by the two-point function of this operator O, okay? Evaluated at this difference, omega minus m omega, where m here is the angular momentum number. All right. Now, by playing exactly the same trick, I can also describe now spontaneous emission. The process now is reversed. And I should say that for simplicity, I've also set the linear velocity of the object to zero, just to make the equation a tad simpler. So now the process looks like this. And you can turn the crank in exactly the same way. And the result you get for the probability of emission looks almost the same, except that now the argument of this function has a different sign. Right? Now, at this stage, everything I've showed you is completely general, applies to any object. How do we go from these completely general results to making contact with a result, specific result for concrete objects? We do it with a procedure called matching, meaning and so I'm going to show you how to do that in the case of a black hole at rest. In particular, I'm going to set the spin to zero at this stage. So first, from a classical perspective, which is what I'm interested in matching, the black hole is just sitting there, and it's a system in its ground state. So this means that the correlation function, it's a very general result in field theory, takes this form. It's non-zero only for positive frequencies, and that's why we have this theta function. And it's proportional to the spectral density, which measures, in a sense, how many states I have for any given frequency. And using this expression, I can rewrite the absorption cross-section in terms of the spectral density.
Sorry,
what is theta? Oh, theta is just the theta function. Exactly. So it just sets this to zero for negative frequencies. So I can rewrite this this absorption cross section in terms of the spectral density, and if I'm interested in particular in the long wavelength limit, this is where I'm going to make the first approximation. I can use the fact that the spectral density is a quantity that is odd in frequency and is positive for positive frequencies, and I can expand this in powers of omega. And this tells me that the first term should start linear in omega and have a coefficient in front that is positive, that I'm calling gamma. So this gamma has different values depending on the object that we are considering.
Sorry, what's V in this expression?
V, so V is the group velocity of the particle that is being absorbed. In general, I'm considering a massive particle. All right, so now that we have a nice expression for the low frequency limit of the absorption cross-section, we can go and do the explicit calculation for a black hole. In fact, Unruh has done it for us in 1976. This is a very fairly technical calculation. It's not fun, but luckily for black holes, it can be done analytically. This is the result. And if you compare this with that, you can immediately read off the coefficient gamma. So now the important thing is that once we have figured out what gamma is for a black hole, this nails all dissipative processes that involve a black hole and a scalar mode with L equal 1. So we can go and, these require doing a technical calculation, but the good news is that by using effective theories, we can only do it, we only need to do it once.
This is just the same value for all black holes, regardless of its spin rate?
Yes. In fact, that's one very important point, that I can do the matching in the simpler case for a Schwarzschild black hole, and then I can apply this number in the more complicated case of a Kerr black hole. So let me show you how that's done. And in particular, let me consider now a more interesting dissipative phenomenon, namely superradiance. Okay? So superradiance comes mainly in two flavors. There is what we call superradiance scattering, and that is a process where you have an incoming wave that scatters off a spinning object. And in the process, it gets amplified and carries away some of the angular momentum of the object. There is a second flavor instead, which we call superradiant instability, where the same object, while spinning, can spontaneously produce particles in bound state. And the production of these particles in bound state also takes away some angular momentum from the object. Now, there are two conditions that need to be satisfied for this to happen. The first one is that the particles that either scatter or are produced in bound states need to be bosons. And the second one is that the energy of these particles and their angular momentum number m needs to satisfy this superradiant condition. Okay? So even though superradiant scattering was first envisioned by Zeldovich in the early 70s, it is remarkable that the first direct experimental evidence we have of this process was actually found just about a year ago. And it was found using a tank with shallow water and scattering surface waves off a draining vortex. And what the experimentalists found was that if the conditions were just right, the outgoing surface waves could have an amplitude which was higher, could have an amplitude that was higher than the incoming waves by an amount up to 20%. Now, in the context of more gravity and cosmology, the other flavor of superradiance, namely superradiant instability, has received more attention. And this effort was spearheaded by your colleague Minar Vanitaki and her collaborators, and more recently also William East has given very nice contributions. And the idea is that because of these phenomenons, black holes could act as probes and allow us to indirectly probe for the existence of ultralight particles that are bosons. Okay, in particular, axions or spin zero, or recently people have considered also the possibility of spin one particles. And the idea here is that if there were axions, then around spinning objects, they would start accreting, creating bound states, and essentially form a cloud. And by doing so, they would extract some of the angular momentum from the black hole. And this process would clearly impact the distribution of spin and masses that we observe of black holes in the universe. But it would also give rise to new sources of gravitational waves, potentially. Now, if you think of this cloud as essentially being the bosonic version of an atom, you could have processes where axions jump from one level to another one with lower energy, and in the process, they emit gravitons. So this would give rise to a monochromatic signal. Or you could have processes where different axions in the axion cloud annihilate, and then they produce a graviton as a result. And again, since mostly one level would contribute, if you do calculations precisely, you would find here that also this gives rise to a monochromatic signal. And this signal could last anywhere between 10 years to 1,000 years, for instance. Or finally, if the self-interactions of axions are strong enough, you could have more violent but transient phenomena known as bosonovae, where at some point, once you reach a critical mass for this cloud, the cloud would collapse on itself and then expand. Okay, these are called bosonovae. Now, let me show you how now we can apply what we've learned about dissipation in the previous slides to this problem. Okay, so from my viewpoint, from my viewpoint, superradiant scattering results as an imbalance between absorption and stimulated emission. Okay, so the outgoing flux here is given by whatever fraction of the incoming flux is not absorbed, plus whatever flux is produced through stimulated emission. And by massaging this equation, I can write down an expression for the relative change in flux. And this turns out to be just given by the difference between the two probabilities, the emission and absorption probability. And since we have calculated this, we can plug in the previous results and find out that this change is completely determined just by the spectral density. So already, without doing any matching, any approximation, we can use this general fact about spectral density, namely that there are odd functions of their argument that are negative for negative argument, to see that when this quantity here is negative, so when the superradiance condition is satisfied, the whole spectral density is negative. And so because of the minus sign in front, this is positive, which means that the outgoing flux is larger than the incoming flux, and we have superradiance, amplification, okay? And so to show this, I haven't had to tell you anything about the nature of the spinning particle. It's completely general. But you know, to make contact with actual objects, for instance, now with Kerr black holes, say, we can make, again, this low energy approximation and expand rho to first order. This is going to depend, again, on this coefficient gamma, which we have already calculated by doing the matching with the black hole which wasn't spinning. And the nice thing is that if we use that value, we recover exactly the low energy limit of a result that was derived by Starobinsky in the 70s, doing a much more technical and complicated calculation that involved the Kerr geometry. Okay? So the beauty of this approach is that you need to do a messy calculation, but you need to do it once. The second time, you get lucky, and you can just reuse this result. And you get precisely the correct low energy behavior.
So what are the corrections to this? Sorry.
So very good. There are going to be corrections that are higher power in omega. But once you, if you want to describe those carefully, then there are a bunch of adjustments that you need to do. First, you need to, now, to be consistent, expand your spectral density to higher order.
Omega. Is it capital omega or small omega? I'm just trying to
see. So let me go back to this, OK? So there are going to be some corrections that, so if I consider, let's say, a massless particle, V is 1, this K is like omega, so there are going to be corrections that are higher order in this, but there are also going to be corrections that come from the fact that I expand, I can expand these to higher orders now. But then I need to include also higher order terms in the effective action to be consistent. And so the lowest order result is particularly simple to derive. I can systematically go beyond that, but of course I need to do a little more work. All right. So now exactly the same ideology can be applied to the second flavor of superradians, namely superradian instability. And now the difference is that what we're going to compare is the absorption of a particle in a bound state rather than the absorption of an asymptotic state with the absorption, with the spontaneous emission of such a state. And if we compare the rates of emission and absorption for particles with L equal 1 and M equal 1 and expand again our spectral density to first order, we found this to be the instability rate. So the instability now is due to the fact that you are emitting more particles, you are creating more particles than the ones you're absorbing. And once again, we can use the same value of gamma if we're interested in a black hole, and we recover exactly the low energy limit of the result derived by Detweiler and Ternov and collaborators. Again, another complicated and technical calculation that we don't have to worry about because essentially we already know the value of gamma that we want.
Where and how in the calculation did you introduce the fact that there was a bound state?
Excellent. So if you remember, I had for L equal 1, I had an interaction that looks like this. So I had some di phi rij oj, right? So in the in the case of scattering, I treated phi as some quantum field, and this was a sum essentially of some spherical waves with some omega L and M. Now, if I'm interested in bound states, then I need to include also a set of modes that correspond to this bound state. So I'm going to have a sum of, say, creation, or better, annihilation and creation. Operators, and in front I'm going to have some mode functions, NLM, FNLM star, and when this scalar field satisfies a Klein-Gordon equation, I can derive some equations from these modes, and in the non-relativistic limit, this equation for the modes simply reduces to that of an hydrogen atom, and so I know in that limit what the expression for this coefficient is. And when I plug this into my previous equation for calculation, for calculating the probability of absorption and emission, I can do the calculation explicitly. And it depends on these mode functions.
So in this case, you're doing superradians for the scatter field, opposed to superradians for...
Exactly. If I were to consider spin one particles, then I would have operators that now involve spin one and so on. Excellent. So just a few comments to tie all together. So once again, I stressed application to black holes, but this applies to any object in the long wavelength limit. So for instance, I could apply to, say, a neutron star. It's just that probably in that case, the matching would need to be done numerically as opposed to analytically. I think this approach really shows the connection between different dissipative phenomena, from absorption to superradian scattering and instability.
Is neutron star dissipative?
Well, the mechanism for dissipation would be different. So in the case of a black hole, this comes from the fact that you have a horizon. In the case of a neutron star, you're going to have some superfluid interior, say, at finite temperatures. There are still going to be a dissipative system. Just the origin of dissipation is going to be different.
So it's not going to be the same calculation. Then,
Sorry?
It's not going to be the same calculation. Or are you saying the gamma is a different number?
The gamma is a different number. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
But don't you get also dispersion? Like you're here assuming that. There's a wave that's coming with omega and k and it's going with the same omega and k. But in the case of neutron star, can you assume that?
Yeah, no. So in the case of neutron star, it would be more complicated in general. Yeah. Now, as I replied to your question earlier, so what we did can be extended to higher multiples and higher spins. And in particular, if we were interested in, say, in super radians that involve gravitational waves, the relevant coupling that we would add to our Lagrangian would be something like this, that involves two operators, Oij E and Oij B, that couple to the electric and magnetic part of the Weyl tensor. And this would determine, you know, both absorption and spontaneous emission and super radiance of gravity waves. But the nice thing is that this also contributes to a completely different dissipative phenomenon, namely the evolution of orbits over time due to tidal dissipation. Okay, so let me just say a few words about that. If we have a small mass orbiting a much larger mass, and you know, it orbits sufficiently far away that we can work in the non-relativistic limit, then our effective Lagrangian is going to contain the usual suspects as first few terms. But then it's also going to contain this term that essentially is the non-relativistic limit of this guy. And this is the term that encodes dissipation. So by using some linear response technique, I can derive from this Lagrangian some effective equation of motions that looks like that. These first few terms, of course, are what we know and love. And then there is this extra term. And the equations I wrote here are particularly simple because I restricted myself to the scenario where the spin of the object is perpendicular to the plane of the orbit. Okay? So notice that these terms depend on this coupling gamma, which now is going to be the quantity that comes from expressing this correlation function in terms of a bunch of deltas due to isotropy times a theta function times a spectral density and expanding this guy at linear order in omega. So this is going to be, in general, a different gamma compared to the one that I showed you before because that had to do with absorption of just scalars, okay? But the idea is the same. And if you stare at these equations long enough, what you realize is that a particular solution is one where the orbit is circular and the orbit is tidally locked, in which case these two terms vanish. What does it mean, tidally locked? It means that the spin of the object is equal to the orbital frequency of the object as it goes around the bigger mass, okay? So this is a solution. What we can do is perturb around this solution and check how long it takes for these perturbations to decay. So we can take a slightly elliptical orbit and make it slightly unlocked. And when we solve the linearized equation for these perturbations, we find that the orbit decays back to being tidally locked and circular with two characteristic length scales. There is one characteristic length scale that I call TE, which is the circularization timescale. And it's nailed in terms of the radius of the orbit, the two masses, Newton's constant, and this parameter gamma that controls also super radiance of gravitational waves. And then there is this this timescale that I call T omega, which controls how long it takes to achieve tidal locking. And a generic prediction of the effective theory is that there is a hierarchy between these two timescales. So this scale is actually smaller by a ratio given by the size of the small object divided by the size of the orbit squared, okay? And this is a completely generic and just follows from symmetries. So, and the nice thing is that, yes? So
there are other tidally locked configurations, that is when omega over theta dot is an integer, right?
That's right.
Yeah, and why you don't see this other one?
Let's see, I would think that over time those should decay to this one.
No, for instance, Mercury is tidally locked to the sun. And the ratio is 3/2 or something.
The resonances, I guess, that's the different. I think those are resonance trappings, which I guess you should have as well.
Yeah, we haven't looked into those, to be honest. So I think this was somewhat simpler phenomenon to study. But But I agree with you. If it's a dissipative phenomenon, then it's something we should be able to, describe. Yeah. So what I was gonna say is just that, you know, the fact that we have this hierarchy of scale is actually nice because that's what our moon is telling us. So the reason why we see always the same face of the moon, it's because the moon is tidally locked. At the same time, its orbit is not circular, it's elliptical, and that's because it takes a much longer time for the orbit to become circular than it takes for the moon to tidally lock to the Earth, okay? So with this approach, we managed to connect various different dissipative phenomena, and all we needed was just calculate one number once.
There are effects there that depend on the composition of Earth and the Earth.
That's right. So
where are those in your calculation?
So at this stage, if you want, there is an implicit assumption, namely that the modes inside the object that gets tidally stretched are gapped. So for instance, if the object had some fluid in its interior, then it would be more complicated because those would be light modes that we would need to also include in the theory. All right, so let me now shift gear and in the last 15 minutes.
So can I ask one last question?
Yeah.
So these equations you have are dissipative, you're saying, right?
Yes.
They are dissipative, so they actually dissipate.
Mm-hmm. That's right. All right, so let me shift gear and talk about a phenomenon now that at face value looks completely different, namely superfluidity. So superfluidity is one of the most impressive macroscopic manifestations of quantum mechanics. The most famous superfluid is liquid helium 4. So when you lower the temperature below a transition temperature, what happens is that unlike a regular fluid, a superfluid doesn't become a solid, but it achieves a different kind of state, a superfluid phase, in which atoms are no longer all independent of each other, but in fact, they behave coherently, and by doing so, they're able to move around virtually with no dissipation, okay? Now, superfluids can be seen not just in the lab, but in fact play an important role also in the sky. For instance, at the core of neutron stars, where neutrons are believed to pair up and form a superfluid state. Or more speculatively, recently interesting models have been proposed where dark matter is in a superfluid state. And the goal of these models was to try to explain certain features of the rotational curves of galaxies, such as, for instance, the fact that the empirical Mond law seems to fit very well the rotation curve of galaxies. But, you know, of course, the kind of superfluids that we have in the lab are the ones that we can study more easily. And so, for instance, for those, we can visualize another very interesting feature of superfluids, namely the fact that unlike fluids, when you stir regular fluids, you can create arbitrarily complicated vorticose motion. For superfluid, vorticity is concentrated along lines. And these are the lines of vorticity. And the reason why you can see them is because the experimentalists have injected a mixture of helium and hydrogen bubbles that float to the core because that's where the pressure is lower. And so you can see these vortex lines, they oscillate. Sometimes they collide and reconnect. And as they oscillate, they emit sounds. And these waves that are produced have a very are called Kelvin waves and have a very peculiar dispersion relation that goes like k squared log k. So understanding how these objects interact with the phonons in the medium is a very interesting field theory problem that I've tackled with Bart Horn and Alberto Nicolis. The punchline of this work is that even though these look like strings, they actually behave in a very different way. In particular, just to give you one example, their kinetic term is actually first order in time derivatives, unlike usual strings. So this means that once you give me a shape for a vortex line, that's it. You let it go, and it's going to move with a velocity that is completely determined by its shape. Okay, unlike a normal string where you can specify both the shape and also the initial velocity profile. All right, this is all very nice, but the excitations that I would like to tell you about in the next 15 minutes are another kind of excitations that can be probed by bombarding the superfluid with neutrons and measuring how much energy, how much momentum is deposited in the superfluid. Okay? By measuring these quantities, we can derive a curve like this, which essentially measures the dispersion relation of the collective excitations in the medium. And there are two interesting regions that I would like to draw your attention to. The first one is the low energy, low momentum limit, where the dispersion relation is approximately linear. And the excitations that live over here, we call them phonons. So these are just regular sound waves. The second interesting region is this dip here. Excitations that live at the bottom of this valley, we call them rotons. And even though they live on the same dispersion relation curve, because they are kinematically stable, effectively we can think of them as being a different kind of excitation. And their dispersion relation can be approximated like this with some constant delta, which gives you just the height of this dip. Then P star tells you where this dip is located. And M star is a measure essentially of the curvature of that valley. Now, these roton excitations are super interesting, unlike other kinds of excitations. For example, rotons that live over here have a negative group velocity, which is just the derivative of energy with respect to momentum. So this means that rotons can have momentum in one direction and velocity in the opposite direction. And this is something that is experimentally observed. If experimentalists can produce sources of rotons that travel ballistically through the superfluid, hit a helium atom on the surface and kick it out of the bulk of helium. And this atom, by conservation of momentum, is not detected over here, where you would expect, but it's detected over there. And so these were atoms that were kicked by rotons that had momentum in the opposite direction of their velocity.
Do these signals some instability?
Not necessarily. So excitations that are around here are completely stable. They don't decay into phonons. So the task that we set out, the problem that we wanted to solve was how can we, together with Alberto, was how can we couple these two kinds of excitations, phonons and rotons. Phonons are easy to deal with because, as I'm going to show you in a moment, they are actually Goldstone modes. So again, we can use the coset construction and immediately turn the crank and write down an effective theory for them that is valid at momenta much larger than the much softer than the inverse interatomic spacing. Rotons, on the other hand, are not Goldstones. This means that they are not forced on you by symmetry, although they've been measured, they've been observed not just in superfluid helium, but also in other systems. But they don't need to be there. And more importantly, they have a typical momentum which is of the order of the inverse interatomic spacing. So pictorially, this means that a roton with the de Broglie wavelength of that order is going to interact with some long wavelength phonon wave, sound wave. And just by looking at that, you get the idea, oh, maybe I can treat a roton as a point-like particle interacting with some long wavelength field. Now, the question is, how does this point-like particle differ from a black hole seen from far away? Okay, so black holes cannot have momentum in one direction and velocity in the opposite. So what is the fundamental difference here? The difference is that the Goldstone modes of a roton are different. We still need three coordinates to describe the position of a roton. But because the roton doesn't have any internal structure, we don't need Euler angles anymore. But we need two angles because even a roton at rest has a momentum in a particular direction. So we need the two angles that describe the direction of that momentum. So now the Goldstone modes are two angles and three coordinates. And a very heuristic way of deriving the effective Lagrangian for rotons is to treat the dispersion relation I showed before as an Hamiltonian for rotons, and with a Legendre transform, jump to a Lagrangian while keeping the direction of the momentum in the Lagrangian. Okay. Now, in the spirit of effective theories, these are just the first few terms that you would write down. And in reality, the effective action would be an expansion in powers of velocity of rotons over speed of sound. But to the extent that, you know, rotons are moving slowly, at least the ones that live at the bottom of that valley, we can forget about those and just work with these terms. So this is how we're going to deal with rotons. How about phonons? Phonons, as I said, they are Goldstone modes. And what is the symmetry that is associated, that is spontaneously broken? This is a U1 symmetry. In fact, a kind of abstract definition of superfluid is that it's a system in which a U1 symmetry, a U1 charge is at finite density, and it's also spontaneously broken. In the case of helium-4, this U1 charge is just particle number. And so using, again, for instance, there are many ways, but using cosine construction techniques, you can derive an effective action that looks like this. So the Lagrangian is just an arbitrary function of this quantity x, where mu is the chemical potential, m is the mass of, say, the helium atom, and pi is the field that describes phonon excitations. So what this action does is it captures the entire hydrodynamic behavior of the system. So in particular, even with out-of-equilibrium configurations, P of x tells you what is the pressure of the superfluid at any point. Its derivative tells you what the density is. And the gradient of the pi field tells you what the velocity of the superfluid is at any point. So now, how do we couple phonons in this language to rotons? Well, we start from the action that I showed you before, and we just implement two changes. Okay, these changes are not arbitrary. They're actually dictated by symmetry, but I'm just providing you the recipe. The first change is that anytime we see an x dot, we replace it with x dot minus u. And intuitively, that just means that what matters is the velocity of the roton with respect to the background superfluid. And by performing this change, what we're doing is we're getting an action that is actually Galilean invariant. The second change is that these couplings, delta, p star, and m star, we actually turn them into functions of x. And what this encodes physically is the fact that when we measure these parameters, delta, p star, and m star, in the lab, those values depend on the external boundary conditions. So for instance, if we change the pressure of the superfluid, these values change. And that is actually been measured for helium-4 in the lab. So what can we do now with these effective actions? So first of all, let me point out that at this stage, this action is an action for a 1D action for a point-like particle, even though a weird kind of point-like particle, that is coupled to fields pi that live in here and in here that live everywhere in the medium. So formally, this problem is very similar to the case where we had a point-like black hole that was coupled to some long wavelength scalars or to some long wavelength gravitons. It's just that now the symmetries that describe both the bulk modes and the point particles are different, but the technique is the same. So with this action, the first immediate application that we can do is study phonon-roton scattering. Now, the reason why we care about that is because when you go above zero temperature, at finite temperatures, you start exciting thermally both phonons and rotons. And this bath of thermal phonons and rotons essentially form like a second fluid. And this second fluid, unlike the superfluid itself, has some viscosity. And how much viscosity it has is determined by the strength of scattering of phonons with phonons, phonons with rotons, and rotons with rotons. Okay? To understand these processes is important to understand the viscosity of superfluid at finite temperature.
Sorry, question. Wouldn't be the number density of, wouldn't the number density of rotons be exponentially suppressed because there was a finite gap?
Very good. So that would be the intuition that we would get if these were gapped particles with zero momentum at rest. But because at rest, rotons also have some finite momentum, their phase space is actually enhanced. And so you have more of them compared to regular gapped particles.
But still, there is the energy is non-zero, like the energy that you need to expand one of them. So they would be exponentially suppressed, basically, by e to the minus minimum energy viable, delta over t, right?
That's right.
So that's there, right?
So you have that, but it's less suppressed than for regular gap particles. And also, I should say, because rotons have been observed also in other systems, for instance, more recently weakly interacting cold quantum gases with the long-range dipolar interactions. So those are systems where these quantities can actually be tuned. And so you can increase or decrease the effect of rotons with more freedom there. All right, so the scattering amplitude for this process is given by the sum of these three Feynman diagrams, where a phonon bounces off a roton or interacts with a roton by exchanging another phonon, or is absorbed by a roton whose trajectory is a little perturbed and then eventually re-emitted, right? Now, when you add up all these contributions, the result that you get is quite complicated. And even in the limit where you start with a roton at rest. Nevertheless, I'm going to show you anyways the final result, not because it's pretty, not because I want you to or I expect you to memorize it, but just to point out that this term over here, so that this result was actually first calculated by Landau and Kolakhnikov in the late 40s, and it turns out that by redoing the calculation with modern field theory techniques, we realized that they had missed this term. And in fact, our result was confirmed by another paper that came out a few months after using completely different techniques. And I think this speaks volumes about how powerful modern field theory techniques are, because mere mortal like us were able to improve on a result by Landau. Now, of course, it took us maybe some 65 years to catch up to him, but still, it's not bad. Now, let me conclude with just a more funny application of this effective theory. One question that is natural to ask from a high energy perspective is how do rotons couple to gravity? So if we put a superfluid in a lab, of course, it's in a gravitational field. Now, what happens to rotons in superfluids? Do they float or do they sink? Okay, we know what happens to objects when we place them macroscopic objects, when we place them in a fluid. How about collective excitations? And to answer these questions is very easy. You take the effective action that I showed you before, and you set this quantity x to its background value. So you forget about the phonons, because we care about the rotons now. And you realize that placing a superfluid in a gravitational field simply amounts to changing the energy per particle by an amount equal to the gravitational energy. Equivalently, this means that you shift the chemical potential per unit mass by an amount equal to the gravitational potential. And so when we make this replacement in this action and expand up to first order in phi and read off the coefficient in front, we find that the gravitational mass of a roton depends on the derivative of this parameter delta with respect to the pressure. So as I said earlier, for helium-4, these things can actually be measured in the lab. And what people found is that this derivative is negative. So because of the negative sign in front, the gravitational mass is positive. And this means that a roton in a superfluid is going to sink. But because the relation between its momentum and its velocity is not like the one for a regular particle, before sinking, it's going to execute some very particular trajectories depending on the direction of its momentum with respect to its velocity and with respect to the gravitational field. So the gray trajectory is what an object with an initial velocity going upward would execute, whereas rotons could behave almost like that, or go up and come down, or execute even more complicated trajectories. Now, this is not something that you expect to be able to measure in the lab for helium-4 and for gravity. But as I said, since there are rotons also in other systems, like trapped quantum gases, it's nice to realize that the way in which you introduce a trap for cold atoms is formally the same as the way in which I introduce a gravitational potential. You just shift the chemical potential by some potential that describes the trap. And now that is a system where I can essentially artificially tune the strength of this trap, and if I want to increase the strength of it, and maybe this could lead to phenomena that at least in a collective sense, in a statistical sense, can be observed. So I think I'm out of time now, so let me just conclude with a few quick remarks. So I hope that at least I've conveyed the fact that effective field theories are a very flexible and powerful tool that allow you to study a host of different problems across the spectrum of theoretical physics and to draw connections among things that at first sight seem completely different. In terms of the specific applications that I've discussed today, there are a few very simple extensions that could be done. In particular, the point-like description of black holes that I gave could be generalized by trying to describe objects that have maximal spin. The action that I wrote was just an expansion in powers of angular velocity over normal modes. So the first few terms can be kept only if the ratio is small, but what if the object is maximally spinning? And also, you could ask if your black hole now is in a ADS or DS spacetime, the symmetries that it breaks are different. So what kind of effect does that have on something like super radiance? In terms of rotons, an immediate extension would be to just consider the relativistic case. And this is something that could be interesting, for instance, in contexts where the superfluids you're interested in are relativistic. So for instance, at the core of neutron stars. And it would be nice to see whether there is a way of testing if the superfluid inside a neutron star has rotons excitations or not, given that, as I said, those are not dictated by symmetries like phonons. All right, this concludes what I wanted to say, so thank you so much for the attention.
So, any of this is calculated and tested? Either, I guess, experimentally, that's what I'm...
No, so I think we put out the paper. You mean, for instance, the rotom stuff?
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So we actually put out the paper less than a year ago, and we would like to find.
But the viscosity of this fluid, hasn't it been measured?
For the superfluid, yes, that's right. So in fact, you could ask were people able to see that there is some discrepancy between. The viscosity that is measured due to the fact that there was these terms missing. Now, it just so happens that for superfluid helium, the contribution to the viscosity coming from roton-phonon scattering is actually subdominant compared to that of phonon-phonon and roton-roton scattering. And so even though the correction that we found is of order one compared to the other terms in that scattering amplitude, that whole amplitude is subdominant compared to the rest. But my understanding, though, is that this happens to be the case for superfluid helium. If you have other systems, like the one I mentioned, where you have rotons, then in principle, the terms that you have there should, the amplitude is going to look the same. But now the relative importance of the amplitude compared to the other contributions could be different. And so it would be nice to check that. But I think it's still experimentally... we're not there yet.
Another question, can we image motion of rotons or not? Or maybe a collection of them or something?
I would have loved if that was possible because you have no idea how much time I spent trying to find a video with rotons and it was impossible. Or even if it's possible, it's not on YouTube. So, so I don't know, yeah.
So let us thank Ricardo again.